Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Ken Ackerman, a writer and attorney in Washington, D.C., since the 1970s. Ken Ackerman has been a longtime veteran of senior positions both in government and private law. As a writer, Ken has authored five major books on Americana. His latest is Trotsky in New York, 1917, A Radical on the Eve of Revolution. As soon as I saw that, I knew I had to get Ken Ackerman on the show. And it's Trotsky in New York, A Radical on the Eve of Revolution. You can find out more about that at kennethackerman.com. Ackerman has recently expanded his writing to include his history blog, Viral History, and a small publishing house, Viral History Press, LLC. When not writing, Ken practices law in Washington at Olson Frank Wieda Terman Matz PC, OFW Law, specializing in agriculture risk management. During this varied career, Ken has testified before dozens of congressional hearings investigating issues ranging from the 1979-80 Silver Corner to the 1987 stock crash, and developed legislation on topics from budget reconciliation to farm policy to electronic eavesdropping to civil service reform to financial market oversight. A native of Albany, New York, and a graduate of Brown University in 1973 and the Georgetown University Law Center in 1976, Ken lives with his wife Karen in Falls Church, Virginia. We'll talk about all of this and much more, but first, welcome Ken Ackerman.
Thank you, Alan, for having me, and please don't forget Albany High School in that list of places where I went.
Good for you. It's terrific. And I think Albany High School, every time something really good like this happens, it's a great thing for Albany High School. Let me start by telling you that as soon as I saw that you had written this book on Trotsky, I had to interview you. Now, you may ask why. I'm going to tell you the story, and then I'm going to ask you a question. The story is, I had a girlfriend back in high school. Her father was a representative of the Russian press in America. This was a time when the Soviet Union was still around. And she got mad at me for something which we don't need to discuss right now. It had nothing to do with sex. And she called me and she said, "You're nothing but and then she used an expletive, Trotskyite. Well, I didn't quite know what that meant. So I ran to the dictionary and looked it up. And the synonym, of course, was troublemaker. Could you explain all of that to us?
It's actually a funny story because Trotskyite is an insult in many, many quarters to this day. Just within the last couple of weeks, there's a big fight going on in England involving the head of the British Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, where he's being accused of being a Trotskyist and that his followers are Trotskyist entryists. The reason, I mean, historically, that this has become an insult. Trotsky was one of the co-leaders of the Bolshevik Revolution back in 1917. He was the most radical of the radicals. But once they came to power, he had a very bad falling out with Joseph Stalin. After Vladimir Lenin died in 1924, there was a power struggle between the Stalin followers and the Trotsky followers. Stalin won. Stalin is not someone you want to lose a fight to. When he got power, he slowly strangled Trotsky. He froze him out of the party. He had him expelled from the capital. Finally, he had him expelled from the country. Finally, he had him murdered. Along the way, he murdered a lot of his family. He murdered thousands of his followers. The Stalinist period in Russia is known for the great purges and many, many, many deaths. Along the way, they turned Trotsky into a public enemy within Russia. He was the chief villain behind all of the show trials. And for followers of Stalin and communists around the world who tried to be loyal to Stalinist Russia, Trotskyism became the worst insult that you could heave on someone who you felt was disloyal to the cause.
So when this young lady called me a Trotskyite, I should have really been wounded to the core.
Well, actually, depending on your point of view, you could have taken it as a compliment, too, because it meant that you were far from a Stalinist, which is not the worst thing to be, and that you were someone who stood up for yourself.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about Trotsky. You talk to most Americans, and they'll tell you the one thing that they remember about Trotsky is how he died. So let's get that out of the way first.
Okay. Well, the way Trotsky died, he was assassinated in Mexico with a man with an ice pick. That's the long and short of it. At that point, he had been expelled from Russia in 1929, and he lived the last 12 years in exile, first in Turkey, then in France, then in Sweden, and finally the last few years in Mexico. During that time, he became the chief critic of the Stalinist regime. He wrote a book called The Revolution Betrayed. He wrote many, many articles. He organized something called the Fourth International, which was a collection of radical groups around the world dedicated to a communism without Stalinism. As a result, Stalin decided he had to do him in. There's a kind of funny story told by Laverty Beria, the head of the secret police. If a secret policeman can have a sense of humor, he described how Stalin pulled him into his office in 1939, said, "Comrade Beria, I have some bad news. Trotsky in Mexico, I understand, is in bad health." And Beria at first didn't know how to take this, where Stalin was going with it. But what Stalin said next was that it would be a terrible shame to our cause if Trotsky were allowed to die of natural causes. It would send the wrong message to all the dissidents.
And Beria got the message.
Beria got the message. Over the next few months, they organized an assault in Mexico City, where Trotsky was living in a compound. First, a group of local Stalinists burst in and shot up the place, but they failed to kill him. Then they arranged for an agent, a man named Mercader, to kind of insinuate himself into the Trotsky household to pretend to be a friend and an ally and a fellow writer. At one point, Mercader got Trotsky in his study. He gave him a manuscript to look at. And while Trotsky was looking at the manuscript, Mercader pulled out his ice pick. It was actually an ice axe, the kind that mountain climbers use. And he attacked him. They struggled. It was kind of bloody. The photographs are gruesome of Trotsky the next morning. But that's how he died.
You used the statement there that Beria, of course, was the second worst person in Russia after Stalin, as we say around here.
Yeah, there were quite a few competitors for that honor. Yeah.
Right. And Khrushchev, of course, bragged about how they disposed of Beria when he came to office. But it is interesting. You used a sentence here, or a part of a sentence, which is communism without Stalinism.
Yes.
What is communism without Stalinism? What's the differential here?
Well, the differential is, and this is all vague because Trotsky never got to put his vision into effect. He was always, he went through several different phases of his Marxism. Early on, he was what they called a Menshevik, someone who believed that Marxism should be a broad movement, you know, a broad political power, a broad political party that could win elections and mount massive strikes. Later, he became a Bolshevik, a follower of Lenin, people who believe that communism or socialism can only succeed, especially in a place like Russia, if it's a small, disciplined unit of revolutionaries ruling from the top. And that was the philosophy that got put in place. In the early days of the Soviet state, Trotsky espoused all of the trappings of a totalitarian state. He supported concentration of power in the party. He supported the war communism, the initial terror, the creation of the Cheka, all of those things. But after a few years, he started to grow dissatisfied with it. He recognized that there was no room for dissent, for debate, even within the ruling Bolshevik elite, the ruling rulers of the party. He started to decry Stalinism as ruled by the bureaucracy rather than ruled by the proletariat, ruled by the workers. What exactly his rule would have looked like if he had won the power struggle rather than Stalin is one of those questions for the ages. People have been debating it for 40 years, whether Trotsky could have come up with something that was more democratic, more humane, but still have been an effective form of socialism. So I don't have a good answer for that, but it's one of the great debates.
When you got through writing about Trotsky, did you like him?
Yes, I did. I did like him. And he's one of those people that you like partly because he's so human. He has so many faults. There are so many things that went wrong. But at his base, he was someone who was trying to do right. And he quickly recognized when things went wrong. I also liked him just for his attitude. He was someone who was never a victim. He was someone who was always an actor. He had a lot of fight in him. He didn't always fight for the right things, but he always had a lot of fight in him. He was someone who you could picture escaping from Siberia twice. He's someone who was very comfortable speaking truth to power. He became well-known in Russia originally in 1905. He led an uprising in St. Petersburg during a series of uprisings that year. when it was crushed by the Tsarist police, he was put on public trial along with 50 other defendants, participants in this uprising. And Trotsky was the one who spoke up in court. He was still in his 20s, claiming that it was right for them to have arms and be ready to defy the Tsarist police.
Yeah.
And he had the backbone to stand up in a courtroom knowing that judges could sentence him to Siberia to hard labor for life. And he did it. He was effective. And in the end, he managed to escape.
Do you think he knew that he was a doomed man?
I don't think he knew he was a doomed man. I think in his heart of hearts, he probably thought there was a way to overthrow Stalin, even when he was in exile in late life.
So let me go back to the name of your book, Trotsky in New York, 1917, A Radical on the Eve of Revolution. What did he do in New York?
What did he do in New York? Well, you know, when I first raised this idea with a book agent, and that Leon Trotsky was in New York for 10 weeks, you know, the pivotal 10 weeks right before the Russian Revolution, I had to admit that no, he didn't kill anyone, he didn't get arrested, he didn't cheat on his wife, as far as I know, he didn't meet the president, he didn't even meet the congressman, he didn't meet any movie stars. But what he did do is almost as interesting. He was a radical. He went to New York. He spent his 10 weeks mostly giving speeches, writing articles. Almost every night he was in front of a group, pushing very strongly for America to stay out of World War I, for the Socialist Party's most radical wing to take control. He became a very high-profile political figure in the city during those 10 weeks. And what was striking about it was he became very well known. He had a following. He wrote dozens of articles. He gave multiple interviews. His speeches weren't just in back alleyways. He spoke at Cooper Union Hall and Beethoven Hall, some of the other major venues. But New York was such a different place back then that you could be a well-known, high-profile person without speaking a word of English and without anyone on the other side of the Hudson River even knowing that you're there.
So how was he heard if he couldn't speak English?
Because New York was different back then. The city had a very large population, multiple millions of people who were born on the other side of the ocean. There were some 500,000 Russians who still spoke Russian. There were some 200,000 Germans born in Germany still spoke German. There were large numbers of Ukrainians, Poles, Irish, and other nationalities. The largest number were Jewish people because they made up the majority of the immigrants over the prior 20, 30, 40 years, coming from Russia, Poland, Ukraine, all those areas in Eastern Europe, and they predominantly spoke Yiddish. The Forwards, the Jewish Daily Forward, had competed in circulation with the New York Times. There were six daily newspapers published in Yiddish. There were four daily newspapers published in Russian. There were three in German, and so on. So you could be a very high profile person by just concentrating on the foreign language speaking circles. He was also very well known within the socialist circles, and the Socialist Party back then was a very large entity. It was very mainstream. There were several socialist members of the state legislature. There were two socialist members of Congress. Not even starting with Eugene Debs, the presidential candidate, who got 6% of the popular vote in 1912. By being high profile among all of these people, you could have a very big role, but not be noticed by the rest of the country.
We are talking today with Ken Ackerman, a writer and attorney in Washington, D.C. His latest book is Trotsky in New York, 1917, A Radical on the Eve of Revolution. You mentioned Judaism. What did that mean to him?
Not that much. I mean, a lot of people make a lot of Trotsky's Jewishness, and he was subjected to quite a lot of anti-Semitism, and he became a target for that. However, Trotsky himself was raised in a part of Russia that was not very Jewish. His family name is Bronstein. They moved out of the Pale of Settlement in the 1840s, Trotsky's grandfather first, under a program by one of the Russian czars that allowed Jewish people to buy farmland. in Kherson province, kind of central eastern Russia, in an attempt to allow Jews to be absorbed into the Russian mainstream. And for the Bronstein family, it worked very well. Trotsky's father, a man named David Bronstein, was a very successful farmer, a very capable man. In Trotsky's home, they didn't speak Yiddish. They spoke either Russian or Ukrainian. He went to the bare minimum Jewish education. He had a year or two in a cheder, and that was it. As a result, he knew a few words and phrases of Yiddish, but could never write an article in Yiddish or give a speech in Yiddish. In fact, when he landed in New York, one of his first interviews was with the Forwards, you know, the Jewish paper, and they asked him to talk Yiddish, and he couldn't do it. And they were very kind of dismissive of him because of that. If you asked him what his religion was, he would say he was a Marxist or an internationalist. That's how he defined himself.
So, of course, when he came, he was followed, I believe, by Kerensky. Want to tell us what that relationship was like?
Well, Kerensky was in Russia. Kerensky did not come to America. Kerensky, or at least during this period.
No, he came later. That's right. You're right.
Right. Yeah. Well, step back. The Russian Revolution took place in two steps in 1917. In March of 1917, there was a popular uprising in Petrograd and several other cities because of very bad conditions. There were food shortages, hunger. It was a very bad winter. So the people rose up. The czars dispatched the army to crush them. The army mutinied and sided with the people in the street. And the czar was forced to abdicate. He was forced to step down in March of 1917. At that point, the rule of Russia was turned over to a provisional government, basically a committee of Duma members, of parliamentarians, one of whom was Alexander Kerensky, who emerged as the leader of the provisional government from March of 1917 until November. When Trotsky got back to Russia, he and Vladimir Lenin, who had also come back to Russia during that interim time, organized. Trotsky joined Lenin with the Bolsheviks, and they ultimately took power by overturning Kerensky and getting him out of the country.
He ended up, I believe, in the Bronx, Kerensky, but that's another whole story.
Maybe, yes, but that was a little bit later. Yes.
Maybe that'll be your next book, Kerensky in the Bronx. Okay, so now we have Trotsky. Trotsky makes a terrible enemy out of Stalin, and we're off to the races, and it ends that way. But has Trotsky and his personality, his persona, his views about democracy or whatever, has that played out in what used to be the Soviet Union and is now Russia to any degree?
Well, certainly. And it also played out in New York City as well, where his impact during those 10 weeks was felt very strongly. In Russia, you know, Stalin took power and drove Trotsky out. But for the next 20 years, up until the 1930s and 40s and 50s, the ghost of Trotsky was always present in Stalin's Russia. Stalin was always accusing someone of being a Trotskyist. As late as the 1960s, shortly after the Kennedy assassination in America, the Russian newspapers printed stories about how the Kennedy assassination had to be the work of Trotskyists. But at the same time, in New York City, during those 10 weeks when Trotsky was here, he became a leader within the Socialist Party, which was then being torn apart by a debate over American entry into World War I. Trotsky became a leader of a group that pressed for the party to engage in mass actions if the country entered the war. That means general strikes and physically blocking the war effort, which would have taken the Socialist Party, the party of Eugene Debs, and many mayors and congressmen and state legislators, and turned it basically into a criminal enterprise. And this was poison to the leaders of the party. The main opponent Trotsky faced at that time was a man named Morris Hillquit, who was the leader of the socialists in New York, who felt very strongly as a matter of principle that socialists had to be mainstream and had to follow the law. And he basically took on Trotsky during those couple of weeks and blocked his resolution, blocked his effort in a very public way.
Was there any effort to keep Trotsky out of the country? Did it reach up into, for example, the White House where people were concerned about this guy being here?
Well, you know, this is the interesting thing. The quick answer is no. At that point in late 1916, early 1917, Trotsky, because of his radical activities, he had been expelled from Russia, he had been expelled from Austria, he had been expelled from France, He was being expelled from Spain. He was denied entry into Switzerland. He was denied entry into Great Britain and just about every other country in Europe. But at that point, America was not in the war. The World War I had been going on for almost 3 years, but America was neutral. And as a result, we were pretty oblivious to events in Europe. We had no secret police. We had a very small military intelligence division within the War Department. The FBI was still very small. Trotsky was viewed as simply one more refugee from Europe. In fact, when he landed, he had a guy who served as kind of a press agent for him for the English-speaking newspapers, and they described him as a peace advocate who was being expelled because he was advocating peace in war-torn Europe.
You also wrote a book called A Young J. Edgar Hoover, fascinating,
yes,
and The Red Scare, 1919 through 1920. So we're in the same sort of ballpark, of course, 1918, the war begins and all, for us. So what did you say about Hoover?
Well, Hoover was a curious character for a lot of reasons. J. Edgar Hoover, in 1917, when Trotsky was in New York, Hoover was still a young man. He was still in law school, living with his parents, hadn't had his first job yet. By 1919, though, just 2 years later, he was working as a lawyer, as a confidential assistant to the Attorney General of the United States. He was a very brilliant young man who learned his philosophy of the world during that very turbulent period during and after World War I, when the country went through a Red Scare, kind of a hangover of the Trotsky visit. Hoover, in 1919, again, he was 24 years old at the time, still living at home with his parents, just 2 years out of law school, was basically assigned to lead a series of raids on radicals, deportation raids, what came to be called the Palmer Raids, where some 5,000 to 10,000 people were arrested in a period of about 2 or 3 months on suspicion of being involved with subversion. Several of them were deported, but the bulk of them had to be released because they were arrested simply on guilt by association.
So what can we learn from the young Hoover that hung over to the old Hoover?
He had a very good appetite for abuse of power. He learned during that period, or he was taught during that period, that when the country faced a threat, that the rule book went out the window and you could do what you felt you needed to do. When Hoover perpetrated the Palmer raids, it was under orders from the Attorney General. And very quickly, just within a few months, as the facts about the raids were released, were disclosed, the country turned against him. And he was called to account, Palmer and Hoover both, Hoover appearing with Palmer before several congressional hearings. They were made to account for what they had done. And Hoover, the lesson he learned from it, was that you can't trust people who call themselves liberals, people who stand behind civil liberties in order to defend what people he considered subversives and dangerous criminals.
We're talking to Ken Ackerman, a writer and attorney in Washington, D.C., The latest book is Trotsky in New York, 1917, A Radical on the Eve of Revolution. Now we're talking about a book that he wrote called Young J. Edgar Hoover. Now, I asked you about Trotsky. Did you like him? You said yes. I'm going to ask you the same question about J. Edgar Hoover.
J. Edgar Hoover is not someone I'd ever want to go out to a bar with for a drink. He was a very talented man in many ways, but he did not have a personality that was attractive. I will say that. A few years ago, there was a movie that came out with Leonardo DiCaprio playing J. Edgar Hoover.
I saw it.
And it focused mostly on his relationship with Clyde Tolson, who was his deputy at the FBI, with whom they were at least best friends. They vacationed together. They often wore matching clothes. In the movie, they're portrayed as basically having a gay relationship between the two of them through most of their lives. And it's a very plausible story, just based on the circumstantial evidence. Now, Hoover and Clyde Tolson were very good at keeping secrets, so no one knows as a fact what their relationship was. But it's very plausible, and it's very consistent with the facts. The thing that was missing from that, to me, though, was that, assuming they had a relationship, a good, stable, healthy relationship, you could go through the records and not find a single case of J. Edgar Hoover doing a nice thing for a gay person who he had come across in his investigations who was vulnerable. It did not spill over in any way.
So let me ask you, what were the politics of your family?
The politics of my family?
Yes. interesting way to figure out, you know, where you're coming from on all of this. Were you affected?
Well, my family came to this country as immigrants in the early part of the last century. In fact, I mentioned in the book in the dedication, my grandparents came to America in 1920. My grandfather came as a direct result. They were, you know, they were Jewish, living in Poland, the Poland that was then part of Russia. And my grandfather had to leave because of the invasion of Poland by the Bolshevik army in 1920, led by Trotsky. They came to the Lower East Side. My parents met on the Lower East Side. Both sets of grandparents came from different areas of Eastern Europe, but they both lived on Cannon Street on the Lower East Side, and that's where they met. That's where they grew up. Politically, they were active. My father actually ran for state legislature a couple of times in the 1930s. He ran for the Democratic nomination for an assembly seat. He never got it, but it taught him in politics, and I think a lot of his attitudes about politics rubbed off on me. I was brought up in Albany, and so I got to learn about politics through the Dan O'Connell machine. I remember my first exposure to elections was as a poll watcher when I was 20 years old at the firehouse on New Scotland Avenue when George McGovern was running in a primary for the Democratic nomination of 1972. And I spent a day sitting in the firehouse watching people come in to vote and seeing how the people from the local machine basically knew everyone in the neighborhood, how they had something to say to everyone in the neighborhood, and some of the games that were played with paper ballots back then.
And what were they?
Oh, just things that I saw as a 20-year-old poll watcher. Paper ballots could be filled out right there at the table while the voting inspectors are watching. No rule against it. There were cases where the paper ballots were taken to the back of the fire trucks to be filled out with the voting officials, where you can't see them. There were several scandals during that period about how the ballots were counted. There were cases where someone counting paper ballots would have a little piece of lead from a lead pencil under their fingernail so that they could mark any ballot that was marked the wrong way so that they could have the ballot declared void. It was that experience, really, seeing the O'Connell machine in action that got me interested in Boss Tweed.
And I have to say, Ken Ackerman, that was exactly where we were going. I'm delighted you made that transition. Boss Tweed, the corrupt Pol who conceived the soul of modern New York. Fascinating. Tell us about it.
Well, Boss Tweed is one of the most interesting people in American history, to my mind. He, on one hand, he is the most corrupt politician who ever served on American soil before or since. And it's not an exaggeration, and it's not even close. The sheer numbers of the amount of money he stole are, to this day, record-setting. He's estimated, he and his group, in the three or four years that they were at their height of power, to have embezzled some between $100 and $200 million. These are 1870 dollars, so that's billions of dollars in modern money. The way he stole elections was prolific. The games they played with vote counts. There was one year, 1868, the year he seized power, really consolidated power in New York City, where a congressional investigating committee found that about a third of the votes cast were either fraudulent or fake. A combination of fake vote counts or of repeat voters or of fraudulent naturalizations, you know, one thing or another. So while all of that was true, all of the fraud, all of the graft was all true, he was convicted of 204 counts of misdemeanor fraud, and that was what put him in jail. At the same time, he did more good for people in that generation than really anyone else. Tammany Hall was the most progressive force in helping new immigrants and working people and the poor of New York City work their way into the political system, get their first job, get their first sense of responsibility, than really any other entity of that time. You know, both of those sides of him were very pronounced and existed in the same person.
How did they get him?
How did they get him?
Yep.
Well, it was actually the newspapers that brought him down. The politicians wouldn't touch him. The prosecutors couldn't touch him. But there were two. One was Thomas Nast, the famous cartoonist, who lampooned Tweed relentlessly. He made him look like a big, fat, goofy-looking guy who there was no reason to be afraid of. He just made fun of him week after week for almost a year. On the other side, you had the New York Times, which dug and dug and dug trying to find the scrap of evidence against him. And finally, there was a group within the Tweed Ring, one particular dissident member of the Tweed Ring, who got his hands on a stolen, hand-copied version of the account books of the Tweed Ring and handed them over to the New York Times. The New York Times ran them on their front page, and that was how it was all broken open. Once they did that, then Samuel Tilden, the lawyer, got involved, and they figured out a way to prosecute him.
Now, what became of him? Did he die in jail?
Yeah, he died in jail.
And you say here in your title, the soul of modern New York. What do you mean by that?
Oh, the brashness, the bigness, the boldness. Whatever Tweed did, he did in a big way.
And so are there remnants of that corrupt politics in New York, in your opinion?
There are remnants, certainly physically. The Tweed Courthouse is still sitting in Lower New York. Whenever you look at the Brooklyn Bridge, it is the product of the Tweed system. Tweed basically gave out the bribes that laid the groundwork to build the Brooklyn Bridge. As far as the actual cheating and bribery and embezzlement, I don't think it exists in the same way, certainly. Ballot box stuffing is very hard to do in this day and age with electronic voting machines. There are very real concerns this year about hacking of voting machines, which is a subject for a whole other discussion. But it's clear that the problem of political corruption has never really gone away. Just recently, we saw the scandals involving the leaders of the New York State Legislature, the Speaker of the Assembly being indicted and convicted for corruption. In fact, I should mention I recently became involved with a group in Albany that's setting up a museum of political corruption,
right,
that they hope to open in 2017, yeah, that will try to educate the public and get people to stand up against that problem.
Do you think that the line, as long as we're on that subject, has been moved?
Sure.
There are those people who think, hey, this stuff has been going on forever, and the Supreme Court of the United States has made it clear, and you're a Supreme Court scholar, that you have to have a quid pro quo, and was there really a quid pro quo in both cases? So do you think, basically, things have changed?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Today, there are a lot of things that people would consider corruption that are perfectly legal. People with large amounts of money, even large numbers of people with small amounts of money, can contribute to a politician. You can meet a congressman, give him a $2,000 check, and as long as you don't specifically ask for something, that's perfectly legal as a campaign contribution. The line is a very vague one. In a way, there's a statement made by one of the Tammany Hall players, George Washington Plunkett, from around 1905, who said, "The politician who steals is worse than a thief. He's a fool." Basically, you don't have to.
Right.
You can make your money through what he called honest graft. And that recent Supreme Court decision that you're referring to, this involves the case of Bob McDonald from my home state of Virginia, makes that even easier.
Of course, the people who are fixing the rules or making the rules are quite frequently the people who say, "But there, but for the grace of God, go I."
Yeah.
Let me go back to your writing, because I'm fascinated by everything you've written. Let's go back in time to the Gold Ring, Jim Fisk and Jay Gould, and Black Friday, 1869. What's that one about?
Hey, this was my first published book. It came out in the late 1980s. At the time I wrote this, I was working as a young lawyer, much younger than I am today, called the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. It was the federal regulatory commission that oversees the futures markets, the metals markets, the agriculture markets, and so on. And I was involved in one of the investigations involving the Hunt brothers and their cornering of the silver market. That was a very high-profile event back in the day. And I wrote a long government report about it and got very interested in that story. But I wanted to be able to tell it in a way that wouldn't get me in legal trouble, you know, for having been an investigator on that case. And so I did some digging and came across the story of two guys, Jay Gould and Jim Fisk, who were two very high-profile speculators, robber barons during the 1860s, who basically came up with a plan to corner the national gold market in New York City. There was something called the New York Gold Exchange. The way markets were structured was very different back then. But they basically set about trying to corner the gold market. And in the course of it, they handed out bribes to everyone up to the Grant White House. There were allegations that General Grant, the president himself, was involved or his wife was involved. But clearly they gave out bribes to people in the White House. They gave out bribes to people in the Treasury Department. They were successful to the point that they raised the price of gold to record levels, only to see their corner broken at the high point by a combined action of the president, President Grant, and a cabal of bankers who planted a lot of money in the market to break the corner. When the corner broke, the price of gold fell by over 30% in about 10 minutes.
Well,
and this was important because back then gold wasn't simply a metal that you traded that was something you used for jewelry. Gold was the national currency. We had a gold-based money system. So when you did this, when you played around with the price of gold, you caused massive economic hardship on the country. And when the gold market collapsed after their corner broke, it drove the country to the verge of a depression. Became one of the major political scandals of that era. And that's the story that I tell in that book.
I want you to just explain a few things to us, or one thing in particular is, what is a corner and how do they do it?
Well, a corner is, it's an old-fashioned term today because financial markets have changed so much. But when you have a market that's based on a physical product in particular, so a market in gold or a market in wheat or even a market in a thinly traded stock, if one person can gain control of enough of the underlying product that they can drive the price, then they can push the price upwards. And that basically is a corner. It's a very difficult thing to do because once you create a corner by buying up so much of the underlying goods that the price has to go up because you're the only person who has it, it's very difficult to unload what you have. It's a very delicate operation. Very few people can do it successfully. The reason Gould and Fisk could do it back then was because our financial markets were very primitive in their structure. They were based on physical delivery of products within limited market spaces. Today, what makes corners very difficult is that our markets are global and they're based on cash transactions and not even cash anymore, on electronic electronic transmissions of value. So it's much more difficult to do a corner today. But that's basically what it is.
There have been allegations that relatively recently, there were those who tried to corner the silver market. Is that so?
Yes. It's never been proven. There have been allegations a few years ago that one of the large brokerage firms was buying silver and was trying to use high-velocity trading in order to push prices into their advantage. This whole phenomenon today of high-velocity trading is something that hasn't really been fully explored and, frankly, isn't really fully understood what its implications are. But that was the allegation, and as I understand it, it's never been proven.
So whatever became of Jim Fisk and Jay Gould? I know Pete Seeger always sang a song about Jay Gould's daughter. Said before she died, one more train she got a ride. Daughter, what can it be? The Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe. What became of those guys?
Well, Jim Fisk was shot dead. He was assassinated. He had a very high-profile affair with a woman named Josie Mansfield, who was a singer, an actress in New York. She started two-timing him with another man. It became a big public to-do in New York City. The other man finally got very embarrassed by it, and he followed Jim Fisk to a hotel in New York one day and shot him in the lobby and killed him. So that's what happened to Jim Fisk. At the time, it was a very shocking thing in New York. It was a big high-profile event. Fisk was best friends with Boss Tweed. The two of them were personally got along very well, and Tweed rushed to his bedside to be with Fisk when he died that night. As for Jay Gould, he accumulated one of the great American fortunes. He took over many railroads. He took over the several telegraph companies, railroad companies. He was considered, in fact, this is a phrase he used on himself. He called himself the most hated man in America because of his stock market manipulations and his very hard line against labor unions. When he died, he was the people celebrated around the country. But the amount of money that he made, that he accumulated, was in the range of $70 to $80 million. And again, this is in the 1880s. So that amount of money today would make him a solid billionaire.
We have one more book of yours that we want to talk about, and that is Dark Horse, The Surprise Election and Political Murder of President James A. Garfield. Two very interesting subclauses there, the surprise election and the political murder. Maybe you could tell us a little about that one.
Okay. Well, James Garfield was elected president in 1880. I got to be interested in him just because I was captivated by the story of how he got elected. I've always been interested in political conventions. Today, political conventions are not very interesting. They're very staged. We haven't had a multi-ballot convention in over 50 years. But James Garfield was nominated for president in 1880 in one of the classic political conventions. It was the longest ever Republican convention. It went 36 ballots. And Garfield was not even a candidate at the convention. He had gone to give the nomination speech for someone else, a man named John Sherman. The race that year was mostly between Ulysses Grant going for a third term and James G. Blaine of Maine, who was opposing him. They represented two very hostile wings within the Republican Party. They fought each other to a standstill for 35 ballots, and on the 36th, the tired delegates turned to Garfield, who everyone liked as a person and was many people's second choice. So he was elected under those circumstances. He was nominated after he got the nomination in order to buy off the support of the stalwart wing. That's the General Grant wing of the party. They saddled him with a vice presidential nominee, Chester Allen Arthur, who represented a hostile wing of the party to Garfield. It was an age when politics was dominated by state bosses, and Garfield quickly found himself in the middle of a fight between two of the most powerful state bosses, Blaine on one side and a man named Roscoe Conkling of New York on the other side. He won the election, but I call it the surprise election, because when the nomination came after this exciting convention, but the election itself was one of the closest in American history. Garfield's popular vote margin was less than 10,000 votes. That's much closer than virtually any other in history. Once he became president, he quickly found himself in the middle of yet another series of fights. The split in the party that had caused the 36-ballot convention lived on, and this split between the two political bosses, Conkling and Blaine, quickly dominated his presidency. And it was that fight that stalled virtually everything he tried to do in Congress, and that inspired the actions of a weak-willed kind of follower of one of these factions, a man named Charles Guiteau, who followed him to the train station one day and shot him in the back.
And what was the upshot of that? I mean, did anybody ever talk to Guiteau? I know there was a trial, right? So
there was a trial. Guiteau defended himself on two grounds. One was insanity, and the other was the fact that it was the doctors who killed Garfield through their malpractice.
Which is true.
It is a fact that when Garfield was shot, if the doctors had simply left him alone and cleaned the wound and let him be, he probably would have survived even in the 1880s.
Or even wash their hands, Ken.
Even very simply wash their hands. It was surprising, but Lucretia Garfield, his wife, was getting letters from frontier doctors saying, don't let them explore the wound. There were plenty of doctors who had learned their trade in the Civil War who helped people with gunshot wounds survive the Civil War. But the doctors involved, immediately after Garfield was shot, they explored his wounds with their fingers without washing them and with instruments without washing them, which was very painful to Garfield. I know they had no anesthetic back then. but Garfield ended up dying of infection rather than the gunshot wounds.
And what was the political upshot of this? Arthur was a bad man, right?
Arthur turned out to be a pleasant surprise in all of this. Mm-hmm. Arthur became president as a toady, really. He was a follower of Roscoe Conkling's political machine. He was considered the gentleman boss of New York. He didn't take money. He didn't need money. He didn't need to steal. He was well off on his own. But he was very much part of the Conkling machine, which helped other people steal. There was a patronage-based political machine, and he was part of it. But after Garfield was shot, during those couple of months when Garfield was lingering on and people in the country were very angry about what had happened, Chester Allen Arthur did a lot of soul-searching. And when he became president, he turned out to be a much better president than people expected. He signed the Pendleton Civil Service Act of 1883, which was one of the most important government reforms of that century. It took the federal civil service and some 90% of employees under the merit system in about 10 years, a very, very successful initiative. He refused, when Roscoe Conkling, the New York boss, came and asked for favors, he refused to do them for him. He refused to appoint people from his New York political machine into patronage spots because he didn't want to become tarred with dishonoring the legacy of James Garfield. So he became actually a very stand-up guy and much better president than people expected.
And what was his future?
He unfortunately did not have much of a future. He came down with a disease called Bright's disease, which was a breakdown of the kidneys, very painful disease, and he died in 1885.
So if Garfield had survived, would Pendleton and these other things have come to pass, or was Garfield's death a sort of blessing in disguise?
Well, I wouldn't call anyone's death a blessing in disguise. And Garfield was an extremely talented person and a very decent person. He really sticks out in that era of the 1880s. So many of the politicians were very venal and very narrow-minded, very power-hungry. But Garfield was a very, very decent man, very idealistic man. If he had survived, he could have done quite a lot. Being shot like that made him suddenly very popular with the public. Being shot and having the perseverance, having the personal courage to suffer through his wounds and to heal, and especially coming after he had had a very large political fight with Conkling leading up to the shooting, if he had lived, he would have been very popular, and he possibly could have made some very real, or avoided some of the real problems with race relations in the country, which were then at a very pivotal moment. Whether he would have signed the Pendleton Civil Service Act is very unclear. He was never a civil service reformer. That was never a very important thing to him. Garfield believed that there was a lot of merit in the patronage system. He felt that when a member of Congress or a senator was responsible for appointing all the federal officials in their state or congressional district, that created accountability. He took it as a real responsibility to appoint very top-notch people to be the local postmasters and the local treasury agents in his part of Ohio. So his attitude about civil service was not quite so black and white.
So it was not that long before that Abraham Lincoln had been assassinated.
Yes.
Was there a sense in the land based on Lincoln's assassination that, you know, that it almost transferred to Garfield in terms of the popular discontent with people who did these kinds of things?
Oh, absolutely. People forget this today. Garfield is considered a very obscure president because he served for such a short period of time. But for people who were alive in 1881, he was considered one of the great figures in the country. When he died from his bullet wounds finally in September of 1881, over 100,000 people came to Washington to see him lie in state in the Capitol. A very large crowd came out to Ohio for his funeral in Cleveland. He was considered one of the great figures, both because of his personal courage and plus because of the fact that he had been assassinated so soon after Abraham Lincoln. People living then would be very surprised to know how much we've forgotten James Garfield.
So when you wrote a book about James Garfield, who was, of course, obscure, did you find it rewarding in terms of people who were interested in this?
Oh, absolutely. I found James Garfield has quite a lot of followers around the country.
And what leads to that?
Yeah, you know, and another thing about writing a book like this, which is a treat for me, is I get to meet many of the family members.
Right.
I had an event for the Garfield book in Mentor, Ohio at the Garfield home. And a lot of the great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren and great-great-nephews and nieces all showed up for it. And originally, I was a little nervous about that particular appearance because I'd always thought if someone wrote a book about my grandfather, you know, our family, we would be the harshest critics, and we would nitpick it and find everything that looked like a mistake. But instead, they were very gracious and very open about it. The parents really wanted the children to know about who James Garfield, their ancestors, who he was and how he died and how he lived. And it was a very, very warm reception. Same is true with the Tweed book. After that book came out, I was approached by several of the Tweed descendants who are still alive. And you know, these are great-great-grandchildren living in different parts of the country who have always been somewhat ashamed by the family legacy because the Tweed scandal at the time was very dark and was very cruel upon the children and the wife and other family members. But they were very glad to see that the positive side of Boss Tweed, the fact that he was a very large figure, and not just physically, but in terms of the good side of his legacy.
It's got to be something to grow up, and somebody comes up to a guy named Tweed and says,
You're a crook.
Oh, or are you related to Boss Tweed?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's got to, in some way, play to a sense of I'm important because I have an important relative.
Mm-hmm. Yes. There's some of that. You know, in the Garfield family in particular, they have a very strong ethic about not trading on the family name.
Oh,
and very few of them have gone into politics. I don't think any of them have gone into politics in the past couple of generations. Several of them served in the military, both in World War One. I remember when my book came out, it was during the Iraq War, and there were several Garfield relatives who had volunteered to be in Iraq and serve in the military. So they had the sense of service, but they also had a very strong ethic about not relying on the family name, that people need to make it on their own.
I'm just so fascinated by your ability to make a good living in law, be a part of a major law firm, and still carry on with this writing. Is that ever difficult for you?
Well, that's been a challenge. I have to say my law firm has been very generous to me. They've let me basically stray away for long periods of time. During the time I'm writing books, I am not making a good living for my law firm, but that's only fair. But they've allowed me to go and do this, to enjoy these two sides of my life.
And what is it about the legal work as opposed to the writing work that turns you on?
For the last 20, 30 years, I have been involved in agriculture. It was kind of a series of accidents. Coming from Albany, New York, I was never involved in agriculture growing up. But at one point during my professional life in Washington, I ended up working for the Senate Agriculture Committee because they were the ones that oversee the futures markets. And while I was there, I did a lot of work on one of the farm bills. And after that, during the Clinton administration, I was appointed to head the Federal Crop Insurance Program, which provides insurance against natural disasters for farmers across America growing all sorts of different types of crops. And during that period, I spent large amounts of time on the road meeting with farmers all over the country in 20 different states, usually after a bad flood or a bad hurricane or a bad drought, to make sure that the federal assistance got to them the right way. And I got to be very friendly with farmers and got to respect them quite a lot. And my legal practice is largely representing either farmers or crop insurance companies in their different fights among each other. They're trying to work things out with the government, making sure that farmers get paid when they have losses, making sure that insurance companies are protected against fraud, that the government's protected against fraud. So that's been the mainstay of my practice. It's been an agriculture practice, which is kind of a surprise for me, but that's the way life worked out.
Indeed it did. Listen, I've had a terrific time. I don't know about you, but I've had a terrific time today. We've been in conversation today with Ken Ackerman, a writer and attorney in Washington, D.C. His latest book is Trotsky in New York, 1917, A Radical on the Eve of Revolution. You can find out more at kennethackerman.com. Ken, thanks so much for joining us today. I've had such a good time.
Alan, it was a real treat. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.